The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors. Keep on, keep on.
All right, good morning. Welcome to Morning Drive here on 89.7 WTBR-FM Pittsfield Community Radio. Sean Sayre here with you this morning on Thursday, March 6th. It's good to be with you. Good to have our listeners along for the ride this morning. Also listening to us down in Lee, Lennox, and Stockbridge this morning on 88.1 WSBR Lee. Starting to hear that word is getting around a little bit. I'm starting to hear people telling me that they're listening down in Lee, so it's good to hear that. And hopefully we can hear a few more people. You know, shoot us an email, shoot us a text or something. Tell us you're listening in South Berkshire County. We'd love to hear that. We have a great show here for you this morning. We have Joe Derwin on the show, local historian, purveyor of the Home Historian and these mysterious hills. Going to be talking about local history, his research efforts, and then, talk about facts and lack of facts and research and pseudoscience. We're going to get into a lot of stuff here this morning. It's going to be very interesting. Looking forward to that conversation. First, let's go to the weather forecast and see what our still available National Weather Service has in store for us today. Berkshire
weather. WTBR radar weather for the Pittsfield area. Wind advisory in effect from 4 p.m. this afternoon to 4 p.m. EST Friday. Today, mostly cloudy. Patchy fog this morning. A chance of rain showers, mainly this morning. Highs in the upper 40s. Temperature falling into the upper 30s this afternoon. West wind 5 to 10 miles per hour, becoming northwest 10 to 15 miles per hour with gusts up to 30 miles per hour this afternoon. Chance of rain 40%. Tonight, mostly cloudy and windy. Much colder with lows in the lower 20s. Northwest wind 20 to 30 miles per hour with gusts up to 50 miles per hour. Weather forecasts for WTBR-FM are provided by the National Weather Service.
Well, you generally have my attention when you give me a high wind advisory and then say 50 miles an hour. So that's something to keep in mind for a little later tonight. If you hear the wind whipping against those walls, as it does sometimes, those big strong gusts, you know what is going on there. Sounds like we've got a weather front coming through. We're going to be a little warm during the day today and then maybe a little colder tonight. So keep an eye out on that. And boy, yesterday morning we had quite a bit of a glaze, a sliver. You walk out your door and immediately you're like, okay, this is not good. I'm going down. keep the handle on that. But yeah, not so bad today. You're not going to walk out today. It's just wet out there today after a long, long day of rain yesterday. All right, welcome again to Morning Drive here on 89.7 WTBR-FM. Joe Derwin, good morning. How are you, sir?
Oh, I'm great. I'm great. This is a beautiful Berkshire morning.
It's not bad.
This is nice to see after a freezing winter. Just wet everywhere, foggy, kind of. Love it.
Yeah, I mean, we actually had a colder winter this year than in most recent winters. The last five or six winters, this is probably the colder, and maybe we just weren't ready for that. Quite a bit more activity in that way.
It was colder, and I'm getting older. that intersection.
Yeah, right. It definitely affects you after a while. But, you know, we're all looking forward to the Berkshire spring for sure. So let's get into the Home Historian and the work that you've been doing. Very interesting to follow some of the things that you post up on social media. Let's start about how you got started doing that. I know we've talked about that before, but it's kind of a niche endeavor, if you will, poking around and researching into the history of some of the older and maybe even some of the newer properties in and around the Berkshires.
Yeah, I kind of got into property history rather accidentally, you know, just from related interests. I started writing about local history as kind of like a one-off article for the old Advocate Weekly for that paper back 2004 or something that mm-hmm. turned into kind of a weekly column where my interest at that point was more on Berkshire folklore and weird history, things like that. It was kind of a catch-all column for things that didn't fit in other parts of the newspaper. Yeah, over the years, you know, I'd be curious about places I lived, buildings, you know, that I visited, mm-hmm. things like that, you know, so I would look into more information and, you know, started to learn some of the techniques and some of the, where the different kinds of records are, because there is no one good way to, like, you know, punch up. It's not like something, you know, where you can punch up a Carfax on a car and get like a history of, there's no one database where all the information about a house is.
Right.
And even the standard kind of databases like the Zillow and the, you know, the real estate oriented websites that we go to have, you know, little or, you know, inaccurate information about the history of the house. So
yeah, and also a lot of times the official state records of houses when they were built and other things like that tend to be somewhat way inaccurate, off, yeah. right? So why is that, you think? You would think that once it's recorded somewhere in an official document, it's you know, always there and it's going to be accurate. Why not?
Most of them weren't recorded at the time, you know, so it's not like something that's been added to since the first houses started to go up in the 1700s in the Berkshires, sort of thing. It's way, way later when people started thinking about having a date on assessor's records for tax purposes. You know, really it came down to property taxes and figuring out and having hiring assessors. And, you know, assessors started as a volunteer thing and it, you know, has grown in cities and things like that. So it's all just, it's work that people, you know, guesstimated, you know, they looked at the style of house maybe, or, you know, about where, what street it's located on and kind of generally when the house is from that street. So if you look sort of, a lot of people have a house that's dated 1900 because that's just, that's a real good, even, could be
close
could,
enough,
could
right?
be late 19th century, yeah. could be early 20th century. It's around in there, you know, but, I would say about around half of all the houses that I deal with, if they're more than a few decades old, the date is off by something. You know, it's either like 1910 when it's really 1913, you know, or it's sometimes decades and decades wrong in one direction or the other.
Wow. And so what are some of the other sort of data points that you look for when you do your digging to sort of place that date a little bit more accurately? What kind of sources do you find, and what kind of time do you have to put in to even do that? And how do you, I guess, a compound question here, what makes you suspicious that some of these properties might not be listed in, at the right date?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's a lot. That's a bunch of good questions there. I think the last question first, the architecture can be a big fun giveaway.
Okay.
Like you can go down, say, a street like Orchard Street in Pittsfield, and if you look online, all these houses are like 1900, and they're screaming in Second Empire style that they're not, that they're, you're much older than that, you know. So it's just sometimes it's just like a case of like, well, nobody was making houses that look like that in 19, you know, after 1900 or something. So that's clearly wrong.
Interesting.
There's interior features sometimes. I mean, when I'm really in doubt, physical examination is usually necessary. Say probably about 20% of properties, buildings I look at, I need to look under the hood, so to speak. You got to get in the basement, the attic, the parts of a house that have been not redone and sided and completely altered. Because houses do get changed a lot of the years.
Sure.
So sometimes a house looks very modern, but it's there's a house I did out in Lenox that I love along East Street that, you know, you would definitely think it was late 19th century, early 20th century because of the way that, you know, the gables on the roof are. And but it's a 1770s house.
Wow.
But it just was, the roof was completely redone by, you know, one of the subsequent owners. So,
How about old photographs and things like that? Do they give you some clues as to what may or may not have occurred from that house, whether it was built and then remodeled and completely changed? Can you see an A and a B photograph and say, oh, I see with the original house there?
On occasion, on occasion, I would say probably a minority of, you know, not to get people too excited, because most people's houses weren't extensively photographed,
right,
you know, in the past. It's hit or miss.
Hmm.
And sometimes it's just out of luck, because there was happened to be a news story, you know, a human interest story, or somebody is being wheeled out in an ambulance from a fire or something at the property. And that's the only reason there happened to be a photograph somewhere in the news coverage.
Huh. That must be very difficult to nail down, though. How do you even find something like that?
Well, I mean, I start with the property itself. I start with ownership and trace back through deeds, and then I go out from there, which can be just rabbit hole after rabbit hole. Once you take a name of a person, once you know the people kind of involved, then you can go out and check census records, vital records of birth and death, and newspapers and town histories. There's, you know, hundreds of books of Berkshire history in the Athenaeum, from, you know, individual town histories to churches, and all these different records. So you can you know, reconstruct and create composites, biographies kind of the people, and that will sometimes flesh out things that, you know, you wouldn't find just looking for the address or something like that.
It's probably unusual now for a lot of those houses to still be in the same family or the same hands as it was, right? I mean, I would imagine it could happen, but for the most part, you know, a house with any kind of history probably had multiple different owners and different families over the years.
Yeah, I mean, it is highly variable. I will say some houses have been through 10 times as many owners in the same, you know, number of years as a neighboring house. It is increasingly rare. You see it more in the older houses from 1700s to the 1800s, more farmhouses and things like that retained in the same family. But I did just do a nice house on 2nd Street, on Lincoln Street at Pittsfield, that had been, up until very recently, had been, and actually was able to flesh in more of their own family history, because they knew that it had gone back to their great grandparents. But then I actually found that before their great grandparents bought it, their great great grandmother had been a tenant there.
Huh.
So then she moved in and lived and died there after they bought it. But she had lived there first, and before that, her aunt had lived there. So there was actually two more generations of the family connected to this kind of, to this duplex house.
And that was something that this current family had no idea, that the history had gone back that far.
Yeah, that far. So it was, and that's when it's really magic. That's when this job is like really worth it. When you can connect people to parts of their own heritage and their own story. And I'll do a lot of past family homes for families who don't live there anymore, but they have sentimental attachment to a childhood home. And when you can find something about their own family history that was somewhere in the records that, you know, or clarify, you know, something that they've been wondering about for years because it was vague, you know, we get these things piecemeal from our ancestors, you know, so
they're passed down as all, legend,
you know,
right?
Sometimes there's just not the chance for some people. So it's really neat when you can connect the dots or something that is, you know, part of their story, you know, not just their a building they lived in, but.
So I would imagine those stories unravel some things that are positive, some things that are negative, some things that are specifically about people, and then some things that are about greater, wider events, right, that sometimes affected many people or maybe the entire community. So to throw a couple of good stories out there, because I know you've got a few under your belt. What interested you, or what surprised you the most about maybe a couple of properties?
I think this always surprises people, but my favorite things to uncover are food stories.
Food?
I don't write as many food stories as I do, you know, things that feature crimes and scandals and things like that. But that's, you know, that's not on me. That's on the human race and their allocation of time.
Well, and also if you're going back to newspaper stories, a lot of times newspapers do report on, you know.
Yeah, if it bleeds, it leaks.
Bad things, right? So you're going to find information about that.
But there are some great food innovations that have happened in the Berkshires. One of my favorite that I came across was the apparent invention of the flat-sided New England-style so-called hot dog bun, hot dog roll.
Okay.
Now, the official story is that...
Now, is this the hot dog bun that's split in the middle or split
horizontally? It's split in the middle, and then it's like toastable on the sides, you know, the kind you slather some butter on, you grill it, you know.
And at one time, that was an innovation.
Yeah, the story goes that that was invented for the Howard Johnson's restaurant, that the bread company created it in the 40s originally for clam rolls.
Sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But as I was digging into a property in Lanesboro that's now a salon, it's been through a couple of different changes of usage, but it was originally a restaurant called the Dutch Kitchen that had was part of this kind of craze when the hot dog craze first came to the Berkshires, and it really did, and hot dogs really kind of became, I think, because of you know, the wave of German immigration to Pittsfield in the late 19th century, and the way that, you know, they just a couple of businesses, you know, became a whole movement. I think, you know, we have a big piece of like this hot dog culture, and you can see it still today in the competitions between hot dog restaurants. We still have a high per capita number of restaurants.
Well, it's one of the things that still attracts people to come.
Yeah.
Many times the highlight of their trip is going to a T.O.'s or a hot dog ranch or a Jack's Hot Dogs up in North Adams, something like that.
Yeah, that's the part of the pilgrimage. and this, you know, goes back in the Worley's family and all these hot dog things, you know, wars go back decades and generations, but in this particular restaurant, they were advertising what appears to, you know, sounded to me like what we say, you know, the ones you buy in the store that say New England style hot dog buns, years before, late 20s, and they already started kind of running like tongue-in-cheek ads about the original, because like people were ripping them off at other roadside. Because back then it was a big roadside stand kind of, you know, cars were taking off and going motoring was like the thing to do.
And it's kind of a portable food.
Yeah.
Hot dogs.
You get hot dogs, but all these different roadside eateries that then kind of grew into larger establishments. But they were selling what sounded to me like these rolls in the 1920s. And then so I looked for a long time for a photo of that. To kind of confirm, and I didn't find it until actually like a while later when the Eagle actually assigned me to do a piece. Kamala Harris was coming to town, and they were looking for history on presidents and things like that. Mm-hmm. So I was looking at past presidential visits to the Berkshires, and there in like 1932 is a picture of none other than Franklin Roosevelt stuffing a hot dog with a flat-sided bun into his mouth, and ran in the Berkshire Eagle, and there it was. It was like, you know, years before this was allegedly invented. You know,
so it's sort of like finding that baseball bylaw in the athenaeum, right?
Yeah.
You found the evidence of the hot dog bun with Franklin Roosevelt in Pittsfield. Yeah.
Only the hot dog is real. I'm not so sure about the baseball thing.
Joe Derwin is my guest here this morning, talking about local history, properties, food, hot dog buns. So how was it tied to that particular house? That's
where they marketed it, sold it originally.
They
started their restaurant there out of their house.
Okay.
And for years, for I think, you know, into the second generation. So the place was open for decades and apparently was ripped off pretty quickly. So chances are, whoever took credit eventually developing this for Howard Johnson's saw it at some roadside stand, you know, in New England that had been influenced, you know, by the, you know, this had taken off. So
apparently no patent, no trademark for the New England style hot dog bun.
Yeah. Yeah. That was quickly ripped off and copied. And, but it's the only way I like to eat a hot dog. If I'm, you know, I don't want a full bready kind of, I want that grilled bun option.
There you go. Give us a couple more stories. What other highlights do you have from properties, houses, that unexpected things maybe that you uncovered as the things, history unfurled for you?
A lot of neat inventions and things like that because of, and some surprising ones. I think partly due to the industrial history of the area between Sprague and GE and all these, there were a lot of people, a lot of patent holders in the area of kind of obscure inventions that are just neat that you can find, you know, a picture on eBay of the thing that they came up with and people are still selling them, you know. And it's just neat to connect, you know, this was invented in the garage of your house. You know, this was like something they were tinkering on in after hours and got a patent for, and it became, you know, and some of them were kind of minor things, but they're, you know, it's interesting to see that like constant low level innovation, maybe not the kind of stuff that's going to make it into the museum exhibit at the Berkshire Museum, but just this constant thread of like ordinary people just developing ideas and tinkering and that's neat to think about that they're, you know, just because I think that's still going on in a sense. There's still a lot of it's sometimes harder to see because it's more online and it's virtual and things, but I think we still have interesting people doing interesting things in tech and all around us in the Berkshires, working out of their homes, and we don't really know about it. It's not really in the news, but it's part of what, you know, it moves, you know, the economy.
It seems like we went through a phase in our history where almost all inventions were made by one person, right? Someone who, that was what they did, was they came up with new ideas, at least, you know, on the face anyway. There were probably some other people involved. I think of Edison, where a lot of his inventions actually came from other people, and he just sort of, you know, stole them and moved along. He was a great business person. But at one time, there was a sort of a cottage industry of people that could invent things, put out patents, and make their entire living, you know, doing that. And then it seems like for a while, it kind of swung over to more of a team sport, if you will, you know, corporations, companies, teams of people, you know, creating things because maybe the ideas were just a bit too complex for one person.
Yeah, the ideas and sometimes the capital you need to test your idea, I think, you know, to develop as things got more, as machines got more complex, definitely. But yeah, there is a lot of that history, like you mentioned, with the inventors and William Stanley, of course, who was very bad at getting the economic payoff of his inventions. He got ripped off a bunch by like Nikola Tesla. He was in court with Tesla for years trying to get like something that Tesla pretty clearly stole from him.
Which is interesting because a lot of things also got stolen from Tesla in history, right?
I mean, yeah,
I guess that must have just happened a lot.
I think, I think Tesla, well, and Tesla was very noisy about it when he had, Tesla was surrounded by lawyers. I mean, Tesla to me was kind of like the Elon Musk of his day. He was very good at self-promotion. Whether or not he invented a lot of the things he said he did was questionable, you know, but he had a lot of money, he had a ton of lawyers and publicists, and he was very good at that self-promotion idea of himself. So, but he snuck in there but William Stanley in some ways was not the best businessman. He was a great inventor, but some of his business savvy was questionable.
Yeah, and yet some of the things that he did promote and move forward were critical parts of, for instance, our electricity infrastructure. Without those things, you know, we'd probably all be on direct current to our homes right now, for example.
And heck, kids are still going to school with, you know, cups with his name on
right.
them. You know, that's some kind of immortality.
And I'm sure that story kind of got buried also in history for a long time, right? And why people now suddenly in the last couple of years, it's very stylish to have the Stanley insulated cups. Nobody really could trace that to Pittsfield in a way until recently.
Yeah, because I think, I mean, the Stanley, the company that makes them now is not in really connected.
Yeah.
Historically, to the original invention of them in Great Barrington, a factory that I think has been since torn down, but you know, yeah, great great local, you know, invention that has gone on and evolved into something, you know, not necessarily connected, but definitely inspired by, you know, the local.
Well, that's, you know, it's a fantastic stories of things like that that do come out, and you you wonder why you didn't know those things before, right? And your experience with a lot of the properties probably uncovers a lot of negative issues also, unfortunate or, you know, really terrible acts, things that happened on and in properties. Anything shock you at this point?
I don't know if it shocks me. It still definitely affects me. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's rare that I get through a whole work week without crying over something, you know, that somebody I never met. But things, you know, rough things did happen to people in a lot of homes, and especially the older it is, the more likely that, you know, not only that deaths happen, because that's kind of seems normal to me in an older home, but, you know, more tragic, you know, really blatantly tragic occurrences and things that would be preventable today, mm-hmm. Or at least much more socially, you know, shocking and outrageous mm-hmm. today. But, you know, it was, people then had all the same kind of issues that we do now, mostly, mm-hmm. you know, minus some of the bureaucratic issue, but they had all the same mental health problems, and mm-hmm. they had all the same, but they also had, you know, a lack of knowledge about a lot of those health and mental, you know, issues. They had, you know, it was still, we're still kind of in the dark ages now, but so it's like the further back you go, the more unfortunate the outcomes can get.
Yeah, domestic violence seems to be a thread that weaves its way through a lot of that, and it's nothing that's ever been solved or cured. You know, and maybe it's a bit more openly talked about now and discussed, but that's something that that you have brought to the fore with some of this research.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's not necessarily the ones that we talk about the most, but overall, like, easily more than half of all the homicides in the Berkshires have been, you know, against women and in most cases partner, you know, domestic violence related. So, and that's still very much a thing. I think, you know, there's been over 20 homicides, you know, domestic homicides in this century. And then going back to before, you know, it ebbs and flows. There mm-hmm. there's waves and cycles and there's patterns, mm-hmm. you know, and that's, I think that's the hardest part, is to watch the patterns kind of recycle themselves mm-hmm. over and over again of history. Because, you know, it isn't totally unknowable. There are, mm-hmm. you know, we haven't invested enough time, resources and attention to really looking, but, you know, the information and some of the solutions mm-hmm. really are there, but we're not that invested in applying mm-hmm. them or researching them to begin with.
Do you find that people these days lose track of the history that already exists, and they say that, you know, things are much worse today than they used to be, not realizing that actually there are some things that were much worse in the past and we've just sort of glossed over those?
Yeah. I mean, I think, psychologists have a whole area of study devoted to the idea of like rosy remembering or rosy retrocognition, where we, you know, we remember the past very differently than it happened. Mm-hmm. And we all do it. I mean, you can't convince me that 90s hip hop isn't better than hip hop now. It's just like on some things, like there's just, you know, we all have that kind of bias. So I think, but it's like a natural part. Something that our brains do. We interpret the past threats as, you know, we kind of diminish things that were negative in the past because they're not a biological threat to us. They're not. It's like an evolutionary response. A snake that we saw 10 years ago isn't an issue, isn't it? That's just a cute, funny story. A snake, you know, right in front of me now is it going to bite me? Like, it's a much more, you know, just so it's the same thing with crime. Mm. Crime now has a sense of imminent threat. Mm-hmm. It can affect my life now. Crime in the past is sort of, and I see it all the time as I post, because I post my Mysterious Hills page is a lot about the macabre and darker part of the Berkshire history. And people do kind of find past the same crimes that they would want, you know, serious justice for. Now they find it almost kind of cute, you know, when it's in the past. It's like when people are drunken assaults and things like this, it's just like, oh, you know, great grandpa was a character. It's just like there is a sort of nostalgia to softening, you know, to everything, like bootlegging, which essentially, you know, in the 1920s would have made you no different than someone dealing fentanyl right now. It's just as illegal, just as deadly at the time. I mean, people were dropping like flies from, you know, adulterated whiskey and things like that. So wood alcohol, what have you. I think there was like a Christmas Eve in the beginning of Prohibition when 200 people around Western Mass and New England just dropped dead from one batch of sold, you know. So this was like, you know, the situation now with adulterated narcotics and people dying and the overdose rate going up. So, you know, but it's sort of nostalgic. Like, bootlegging is cool. Being a heroin dealer is not cool. Like, because we've kind of changed the definition. We retroactively, we see it through the lens of now being, you know, purveying alcohol is perfectly acceptable. It's like the main, one of the main industries around here. It's, you know, rarely see a city council without a liquor license holder on it. You know, it's just part of, you know, the established culture. So.
Yeah. Joe Derwin is my guest here this morning. We're on Morning Drive on 89.7 WTBR FM, Pittsfield Community Radio, also 88.1 in Lee. And we have reached that top of the hour break, Joe, so we're going to take that right now and come back and talk about some other very important things around the topic of pseudoscience and our current issues with outbreaks, measles, things like that. Very important to talk about. We're going to do that in just a moment. And first, let's take this break. This is Morning Drive. We'll be right back.
Stay tuned for more Morning Drive here on WTBR FM. You're tuned to Pittsfield Community Radio, 89.7 WTBR FM Pittsfield and 88.1 WSBR Lee.
Support for WTBR comes from Berkshire Community College. Free community college for any Massachusetts resident without a bachelor's degree at BCC. Find out more at berkshirecc.edu. And from UCP of Western Massachusetts. UCP of Western Mass is hiring full and part-time opportunities to provide a life without limits for people with disabilities. For more information, ucpwma.org/jobs.
Wonder what happened to those great local PCTV channels? Did you lose them? No worries, they're still there. Go to cable channels 1301, 1302, and 1303 to watch the best local content on television. News and information, sports and entertainment, city council, school committee, July 4th parade. It's all there waiting for you. Pittsfield Community Television. For over 30 years, we are still your local television.
Let's take a moment to talk about your wellness. Financial wellness, that is. Plan your meals out in advance and shop for the week. This will deter you from spending more than you planned.
Pay yourself first. Think of your savings like a bill you pay monthly. This way you can be ready when life happens.
This money hack brought to you by your neighbors at Greylock Federal Credit Union. All financial education and coaching resources are free and open to the public. Greylock Federal Credit Union, insured by NCUA.
Hi, it's Jen Glockner. I'm the director of the Office of Cultural Development for the wonderful city of Pittsfield, and I also host the Cultural Pittsfield radio show on WTBR. It airs every Friday at 8:30 in the morning. Stay tuned to learn all about the arts and culture scene for the city of Pittsfield and beyond. We hope you listen in every Friday at 8:30 on 89.7 FM WTBR.
Support for WTBR comes from Greylock Federal Credit Union, proud to support high school arts and sports programs to help our community thrive. Greylock Federal, with locations throughout the Berkshires and online at greylock.org.
Missed an episode of your favorite show? Have no fear, because we have podcasts. Type in WTBRFM.com/podcast on your favorite browser and search for your favorite show. It's that simple.
You have chosen wisely.
WTBR. And now back to the Morning Drive on WTBR-FM, Pittsfield Community Radio.
All right, welcome back to the show. This is Morning Drive, 89.7 WTBR-FM, Pittsfield Community Radio, 88.1 WSBR in Lee. And I want to welcome our listeners back to the show. Joe Derwin is my guest again this morning. He, the home historian and local history researcher, going to be talking about some science and medicine here in the second half. First, let's do the weather forecast from the National Weather Service and see what we have in store for us. I think you're just going to hear about today because of all the wind. But here we go.
Berkshire weather.
WTBR radar weather for the Pittsfield area. Wind advisory in effect from 4 p.m. this afternoon to 4 p.m. EST Friday. Today, mostly cloudy. Patchy fog this morning. A chance of rain showers, mainly this morning. Highs in the upper 40s. Temperature falling into the upper 30s this afternoon. West wind 5 to 10 miles per hour, becoming northwest 10 to 15 miles per hour with gusts up to 30 miles per hour this afternoon. Chance of rain 40%. Tonight, mostly cloudy and windy. Much colder with lows in the lower 20s. Northwest wind 20 to 30 miles per hour with gusts up to 50 miles per hour. Weather forecasts for WTBR-FM are provided by the National Weather Service.
All right, so prepare for those winds a little later today into tonight overnight. Definitely up into the 50-mile-an-hour gust. That's nothing to write home about, but it's not all that great, honestly. At least we're not up in the hurricane level for this particular event. Morning Drive here returns, and Joe Derwin, thanks again for being here today.
Yeah.
Always appreciate it. Let's go and angle a little bit off of the research, and it's sort of still related, right, because we're talking about scientific research now, the types of things that for many years people took for granted. And we'll talk about pseudoscience, the idea of, you know, unproven science research, beliefs,
more than
research and facts and science. Seems like we're in an era right now where there's a rise of that. What do you think we attribute that to?
I think there's a whole constellation of kind of factors. The internet has played a role. I mean, in general, we're in a misinformation kind of era where all new kind of styles and platforms of, you know, spreading misinformation and the rate at which it can spread has all changed, you know, dramatically in our lifetime. So there's that.
And I think about the era of the late 1800s with the snake oil salesman, right?
Yeah.
The people that are selling you the tonics and the things that are, you know, guaranteed to solve 13 different ailments that you might have. Is it any different than that?
There's a lot of parallels. There's differences. There's a lot of similarities. And I think you do see an explosion of this with leaps in, every time there's a leap in information, there's a subsequent leap in misinformation and disinformation.
Is that a backlash, or you think that just comes along with the territory?
I think it just travels the same road.
Yeah.
I think the same technologies. I think once a printing press was invented, it was equally, had equal utility in misleading as in informing.
Interesting.
You know, and so every leap forward, photography, you know, led very quickly to photographic fakery and, you know, all those fairy pictures that fooled Arthur Conan Doyle and stuff like that. You know, there's, you know, every wave of journalism where there's increased investment in new platforms and expressions and tools, there's a new wave of kind of pseudo thinking and counter, you know, because then anyone can use the same tools.
Mm. So it's driven in a way by technology, you would say, that we expect that things that we will have to continue to understand what the real truth and the facts are based on what we currently use for technology and what technology is driving this.
Yeah, and unfortunately, the more egalitarian a platform is, the more egalitarian a technology is, the faster misinformation will outspread correct information. It seems to be a natural thing, and they have now mathematically, you know, tested this hypothesis in several studies where you cannot spread correct information at the same rate as misinformation. It spreads much faster through social media.
Mm-hmm. It seems like now things are even more out of control in that regard than they have been in the past, and maybe you can set the record straight on that. Is it really worse now, or are people just believing stuff that is not scientifically provable and still, you know, believe it with 100% of their being? Is there more of that now than there was in previous generations?
There's more extremity of it now in a mainstream context. I'll say this, you know, when I was a kid, nobody was a flat earther. I mean, there wasn't a real, there was like a joke of a flat earth society, but there wasn't, they didn't have conventions. They didn't have, you know, meetups and like a social, you know, community. This is new to the last 10 to 15 years that there are a lot of like I know of people around here locally who are flat earthers, you know, like that's new.
And not just as a hobby.
Yeah. Not, I mean, it's
like,
you know,
I might be a Star Trek fan and I might go to a Star Trek convention, but I can draw the line and say, I know that's fiction.
Yeah.
Right, I enjoy that because it's a fun story.
Yeah,
it's not that I'm going to believe that there's, you know, a universe that these people exist in.
Yeah, and I think you know, that's flat earthing. You know, stuff started maybe as an internet trolling kind of like, just you know, a way to be edgy. But and I think there's a certain amount of denialism now that's what it still is, but it really has grown. And if you look at the pretty reliable opinion polls from like Pew Research and things like, you know, some of the more reliable polls, a growing number of people believe very extreme things like the earth is flat, you know, all of history has been fabricated, you know, ancient alien civilizations, et cetera, things that would have been considered way fringe and or like, you know, there was a time you might have been committed for believing that to be the case and telling somebody that. Now it's just, you know, people get hundreds of thousands of followers online for saying things like that now.
And of course, that's got to be rolled into the conversation about medicine, about vaccines. We were talking about snake oil and about, you know, supplements and various things that have a dubious distinction of whether they are effective or not. There was even science in the last couple of years that a very popular cold medicine, for example, was not effective, even though it was one of the most popular things on the shelf. People would go, they'd take it, they thought they'd feel better having a cold or a flu or whatever. Completely ineffective. That's what science said. And yet, people would still buy it, and it's still being marketed as being effective, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'll probably get some people mad about this, but there's still people who believe homeopathy works, you know, over 100 years after it's been debunked as fraudulent and impossible by what we know of physics and chemistry, et cetera. But, it, you know, there once something is entrenched, it's very difficult to get back. And things over the counter, aren't really regulated. I mean, people are much more afraid of prescribed pharmaceuticals, I find, but the seems like the regulation is much more stringent of prescribed pharmaceuticals. Everything that you're getting from a pharmacist has at least a couple more layers of regulation and scrutiny than things that are sold over the counter.
To get something FDA approved is different than getting something that's FDA cleared, right?
Yeah.
Cleared basically just means you can take it and it probably won't kill you.
Yeah, they have not evaluated the any claims. They haven't evaluated any safety levels. You know, they just haven't. There hasn't been, you know, evidence of, you know, mass toxicity and mass poisonings from it.
Yeah.
Substance. That's all you really know about it. You know?
And some of these treatments and various things that are sold over the counter, they're not cheap either. If you looked at some of the prices of some of the things that are pushed on television advertisements ad nauseum, and you can think of a few, I won't call them out, but you know which ones they are. You go to the drugstore and you look and you say, that's $75? I mean, I'm laughing, but I mean, I know some people will take them and swear by them. And yet again, no proof.
Yeah, none. And it's really, it's a multi-billion dollar industry of, you know, alternative products to, you know, that are sold on the basis of, you know, what the establishment's trying to give you is poison. Mm. So take this, which we have even less studies to back up, if any, you know. So it's the same capitalistic matrix. It's the same business model, but it's, you know, one, the medications, the establishment medications, if you will, you know, the big pharma, has to jump through a lot more hoops than, you know, some of the herbalism and supplement products.
Yeah.
Ever have.
So. And of course, that leads us to the discussion about vaccines, and that's in the news right now with great, huge measles outbreaks, people, children dying from this. Many, many people from my generation who are about my age have never really had to think about this very much. If there were measles outbreaks somewhere, it was in a foreign country maybe where they hadn't you know, worked out the vaccines and gotten the immunity into the population. And yet this sort of trend of misinformation, of believing in some of the pseudoscience, has that led us to this point now where we're going to have to deal with this all over again, where past generations had a lot of run-ins with this?
I think this is, the measles thing is very upsetting to me, because it's something I see, oddly enough, you know, I see a lot of measles in doing histories of, you know, local families. Measles claimed a lot of lives, a lot of children. And if it wasn't the main cause of death, it was, you know, it preceded the main cause of death. You see, anytime there was a outbreak of measles going around in the Berkshires, you can look in the death records and find a whole bunch of dead children from, you know, colds, pneumonia, you know, all different causes because of the immune decimating effects. So this is something that, like you said, I mean, measles has been very lethal in countries that don't have the same privilege, like vaccine access, that the United States has. So it's like shocking and tragic, you know, to see, like, this is the stuff, you know, like the commercials when we were kids that, you know, like send money to different countries because they're still, you know, they're covered in sores and their children are dying of measles. Like that's a terrible condition.
Yeah.
And it's something that, you know, it's hard to believe that we are voluntarily bringing that condition back on ourselves. And that's a case where misinformation and pure, like the, you know, vitamin A cannot treat measles. Like it cannot prevent, you know, it can be used when you already it can be used for treating measles, can't be used to prevent measles. And there's a lot of that talk going on that, you know, just take vitamin A and you don't need a vaccine.
That's very frustrating. And the other two things I heard, and I laugh because I can't believe it. I think that's my reaction to it. Cod liver oil. ivermectin. I mean, these are things being thrown out, and unfortunately, at this point, we also have someone who is the head of Health and Human Services cabinet level department who has touted this stuff for years. So, you know, what is the future for us? Where do we look, I guess, now for accurate and scientific information in this era where we know we have to protect ourselves? We may not have sort of government agencies or anyone else sort of towing that line for us.
I mean, I think we will still have the scientific community. And I think one of the biggest misnomers throughout COVID, one of the biggest sound bites that people throw is that it's just, you know, the government is telling us this. Government is telling us to wear masks. The government, it's like, no, you can check with any accredited medical organization. You go to any university in the world, they're going to be saying pretty similar things. So you can still go to the scientific data. You can still go to, and it's gratifying. It's a little scary to see, like, I saw the Texas Department of Public Health had to really push back on some of the misinformation about measles, because they have, of course, the biggest epidemic, the outbreak right there. And there's a lot of nonsense going around, and they had to actually, but it's also unfortunate that they have to take their time away from mid-outbreak. They have to be putting time into social media and containing rumors and nonsense, because, I think some people are profiting off that nonsense, and then some people are just genuinely been led astray by kind of a culture of pseudoscience, thinking that we're all somewhat complicit, and we've all, been taken in by stuff over the last couple of decades through the internet and the quickness of our brains to receive information compared to the time it takes to fact check, you know.
Yeah. What do you think is behind this effort? Because usually something like this that gets out of hand, where misinformation is propagated and then, you know, finds its way to people and people start believing it. But is it a profit motive? Is there a power motive somewhere? I mean, where do you think this comes from, and why isn't it being pushed back against?
I think there's a bunch of different angles that it's coming from. I think there's a profit motive. There's charlatans out there and such. There's an ideological kind of ego motive of people who deeply believe they're right, deeply believe they're right, and would fight to the death to get, you know, this anti-vaccination kind of message out there. And that's just a kind of like a religious impulse that's the hardest one to deal. And then there's a political misinformation that benefits both entities, you know, within this country, who can benefit by destabilizing, and foreign. I mean, if you really look, it's not a conspiracy theory. It's known now that, you know, outside agencies of foreign countries have used social media misinformation to destabilize, you know, things in the U.S. With respect to outbreaks and things like that. And, you know, you can confirm that yourself by anytime you see one of these anonymous, pages on Facebook, these conspiracy pages, just give a check of the page transparency, click on the page transparency feature, and you'll find that it's, you know, even though it may claim to be based in this country, it's out of a server farm in Nigeria or Macedonia or something like that. And it's like, why are all these people with pages, you know, why are people in so many different countries creating pages about U.S. politics and U.S. like issues? It's, you know, it's to spread the misinformation that, you know, I mean, fueling an outbreak is, you know, if you're a country antagonistic to the United States, fueling an outbreak is a legitimate tool of statecraft. It's a military, you know, it's the modern kind of spycraft. It's much easier to get countries to destroy themselves now in the internet age.
Very divisive, for sure. And also, I think it might be a generational thing, too, that there are certain generations that are automatically skeptical of information that they might see and hear and read. And I think that's probably a healthy thing for our current climate, to be skeptical of everything that you hear and see, and not just take it for fact, but actually maybe go back to the first part of our program today. Do some research, maybe.
Yeah.
Listen to a couple of other voices. Look for facts. Look for science. Look for someone who, in an authoritarian position, who has done that work, who has done that research. And even then, I suppose, you can't believe 100%, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think most of the time in life, we're not really required to have 100% certainty on things, you know? Sometimes, we go all through our day making bets and making our best bets on the information we have, and understanding that we can't, each of us, ascertain all the facts of everything about any, there, even in one field of study, you cannot know everything out there that there is to know. So we,
it's important to know when you don't know the whole story too, when everything hasn't been revealed, not to make a decision on something because you don't know.
I think there are ways that we can better educate the public about how to make those bets, about, the meaning of levels of scientific evidence, what the difference between, here's a link to a study, how to determine, this is a study with, 19 people that was, and it's in Swedish, and, it's in a journal nobody's ever heard of, how to differentiate between the levels of what is scientific consensus, a lot of people think that's just like scientists getting together and voting, taking a parliamentary vote. But it's the consensus on something like climate change. It's based in the consensus of evidence. It's the amount of confirmable, replicated information that many different experts have been able to replicate in different studies. So there are things that, but I think we got to start younger, and we've got to start with that more basic critical thinking, basic science literacy. Then I think by the time people have been hit with all these advanced topics in science, there's people who can make themselves experts in certain things, but it's all BS. It's all, they've learned a ton of wrong information. So they're very, very knowledgeable, but it's backwards knowledge, for lack of a better term.
Yeah. And I think of the, the traveling road show, right, with the expert that's on the back of the wagon wheel, touting, whatever it is they're selling. Sure sounds like they're an expert to me. I guess I'll just believe that. But, I don't know that that's changed that much since then, except maybe as you mentioned, the technology and amplifying it and getting that the misinformation around much quicker into many, many more people at once.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think we're starting to see a kind of a new twist in the last, just couple of years, where there's more activist scientists. There's scientists who are just they don't even really want to be doing it, but it's there's a necessity for them to take more initiative and get more, do more public, interface. And it's rough because some people went into, laboratory research because they didn't really want to do a lot of public interviews, I think that's, hopefully that'll increase. And
are you concerned with the availability, the easy availability though, of quality research that the government has, U.S. government has been keeping for many, many years? And I think about climate science and the weather, certainly about medicine and things like that. A lot of these databases are reportedly disappearing, going away. The people who were working with them are being laid off and fired en masse. How difficult will it be in the future to do the kind of research you do to keep the information flowing?
It's going to get harder. It's going to be more of a challenge. The particular areas I work in probably won't be among any of the first to be affected, but for, I think it's already starting to show in our ability to respond, health departments respond to, this measles situation. Mm-hmm. I think the data reporting, you know, I think we're just starting to gut that informational base that is one of the only bulwarks that's holding this, you know, avalanche of misinformation just on the internet from just engulfing everybody. Yeah.
Joe Derwin, we have to wrap up there. We're out of time. It's been great talking to you this morning. As always, we'll do it again real soon. Appreciate the time.
That was quick.
Good luck with your work. If people want to get a hold of you, how do they do that?
You can find me at BerkshireHomeHistory.com and TheseMysteriousHills.com.
There you go. All right, everybody. Have a great day out there. Hope you enjoyed the show today, and we'll be back with another one tomorrow here on Morning Drive. I'm Sean Sayre. Have a great day.